away. So rather than me waxing poetic about commencement 2022, why don't we bring our guest?
Well, let me double track on that just to mention something I mentioned last week, that I think this particular class are going to be certainly well equipped to adapt to change and to pivoting and to sort of moving into a completely different world, literally in a moment's notice, which is something we've gone through certainly over the last 3+ years. And I think that kind of relates to who our guest is today.
No doubt. It's been unprecedented times. And we all, I think, have a different purview of what that has looked like to us. But the person who had, I think, probably the best seat in the House at commencement, at least from my vantage point, was our president, Russell Cavalluna. And Russ, we welcome you to our airwaves today. We are so very excited to not only welcome you to talk about these most recent events with commencement, et cetera, but also an event that we sort of heard about a bit ago and are kind of still processing, as we know you are moving forward in your academic career. To take a new position as Chancellor of Virginia's community college system in the state of Virginia. So we congratulate you, we welcome you, and we're just very excited to catch up. It seems like it's been too long, but welcome to our airwaves and to the WHFR Journal.
Hi, Susan, Alan, it's good to be back with you. It's always an enjoyable time to discuss HFC and the things you just described, our college, our commencement, our students.
We are very excited to have been a part of this sort of this transition, this growth from what the past couple of years have been like with the non-physical, literal commencement to finally getting back on that big stage at the Ford Performing Arts Center and being able to actually get that firsthand experience of seeing the students walk across and letting them celebrate in a very active and physical way. celebration takes many forms, certainly, but what was your take on commencement 2022? And did it have the same vibe as you recall from, you know, a few years back?
Well, I was completely blown away by how wonderful it was. And I mentioned to one of my friends, I was a little embarrassed to admit how surprised I was, because I always have loved commencement. But this commencement felt better than anyone I've ever done. And I think it was probably because we haven't done it for so long. It was also because we had almost 3 years worth of graduates to come and graduate. And people were really excited about being together and celebrating the human interaction of celebration. So it was just wonderful. And as I say, I'm a little bit embarrassed to admit that, because I think I may have forgotten how wonderful it is to celebrate the work that we do together. And Susan, I as you were asking that question, I remembered the last graduation we did was one that you helped me with, and I got a sense of what it was like to be one of the lucky students who worked with you, because I recorded my commencement speech. We did our commencement virtually, and I got to stand in front of the camera as you were behind the teleprompter, and I had some feeling and appreciation of the students and how they benefit from your year-a-day tutelage. And I will say, it was a different experience than that. And without your guiding hand, I was a little bit on my own there on the stage. But we got through it, and we got to shake hands, and it was just a fantastic, fantastic commencement.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's talk about the last couple of years. And I think it's safe to say, obviously we weren't, you know, part of the hiring committee or anything like that. But when you first started, one of the first things that happened that when you came on campus was to meet us on the WHFR Journal. And we've met several times since, just from my own personal reflection, seeing you interacting with students around campus and things like that. What has the past couple of years been like for you when it comes to that, in terms of those interactions with students, and how did you manage to, you know, feel that even when we physically weren't there on campus, I guess?
Well, it's funny, Alan, in the interview process, they did not ask about how you would plan to deal with the worldwide pandemic.
I didn't think that was not going to be one of the questions. I assumed that as well. Yes.
Yeah, they dropped the ball there, didn't they?
Yeah, right. Well,
I have to tell you, if that would have been one of the questions, I would not have had a good answer. I might have an answer for it now, about a half answer. So during the last 2 years, when we were segregated from students and completely isolated from them during the first part of the pandemic, I got to tell you, I suffered without the interaction. I know some of my colleagues like you all who have devoted your life to teaching face-to-face suffered without that human-to-human interaction. And part of what I probably was surprised by in last weekend's commencement was how wonderful it was to have one of those really pivotal, poignant human-to-human interactions that we come together and celebrate in each other's presence. But in those 2 years when we couldn't be around each other, I started to realize that there were opportunities to try to simulate some of that. And while we never quite got the full person-to-person, president-to-student interaction that really drives me and inspires me, we did a couple things that got maybe the glass half full. We started meeting once a month in an open forum called First Fridays, where everyone who wanted to come in a venue that we became also familiar with, a virtual venue, I hosted an hour-long discussion where there was no agenda except students and faculty and staff could ask any question and have any discussion. And a lot of times, Alan, it organically turned into students and staff communicating with each other and complimenting each other and again, replicating some of the things that we enjoy just walking past each other in the sidewalks and halls of our campus. I also started popping into classrooms, very similar to some of what you all had, and saying hello. And then we did start slowly bring students back. And I've been walking through the campus again now and interacting with students. And it has been a slow but gradual process to get us back to that thing that I love so much. And I, you know, when you're saying when I first came here, I'm a little bit scared to say this, but I wonder what it would sound like if I listened to that interview in 2018.
I'd probably have a copy of it somewhere here, yeah.
A young and experienced guy, I'm sure, is on that tape.
Well, there is then obviously, yeah, no. And let's sort of again, like we do, we pivot. What are you going to take from you moving into this new position, which seems like a pretty formidable one? Over an entire district of an entire state. What have you learned from here, and what are the things that you can take with you going forward?
Well, probably the most important thing that I take with me is a complete affirmation of my belief that these careers that you have and that I have to serve students is, next to a family and religion, some of the most motivating things you can do with your life, helping students achieve better lives through public education. In the last 4 years and all that we've been through, I've just been repeatedly reminded about what a wonderful opportunity this is. And that infuses my passion for three things that I've enjoyed here at HFC and that I hope to be able to use for the rest of my life in all my professional endeavors. And that is public education changes lives. That's one of my major passions. And I've seen that through my own life involving two parents who went to community colleges from meager means. The second passion I have is leadership in team environments. And we've worked really hard to build good teams at HFC, and the best evidence of that is how we managed the pandemic. And once you are a part of a really good team, whether you're the bottom of the pyramid or the top of the pyramid, it's really enjoyable, especially when you're doing something that's bigger than yourself, like public education. And then the third passion that I hope to be able to take and continue to enjoy is public service. I've worked in the private industry, I've worked in government industry, and this place, public education, is really the sweet spot, in my opinion, for public service that is directly tied to taking care of and helping a community, and sometimes it avoids a lot of the politics that other public service jobs offer. So Those are the things that I thought I would enjoy about this job, and then the things that I have been reaffirmed in month after month after month here. And I'll carry them with me for the rest of my life.
So many things, Russ, that you did accomplish here at HFC that fortunately you got to kind of see them sort of come full throttle, and things like the new strategic plan that we've all been talking about and buzzing about, which we're very excited to continue to implement, and things like the nearly $7 million in state funding for the tech building renovations, implementation of the integrated energy master plan, money from the Ralph Wilson Jr. Foundation for the new middle college trade school program, and I could really go on and on. So these are things that I know you had on your radar, or they came up on your radar. You did what you needed to do, and we've made them happen. And while this is an interview based on celebrating you, we're also excited to talk about some of the things that that maybe you've started that haven't quite, we haven't had the time to complete or to finish. So you're sort of handing off the baton to a committee, at least at this point, and then eventually the next person's going to hold that as president of HFC. Can you speak to any of those things? And again, we literally could talk our entire time about the amazing things that you've done to contribute to the success of our school. So I'll say now, and I'm sure I'll say it again before we wrap up, we thank you for all of those things. But what are some things that are in the works, or you just didn't quite get to, but you're hoping to keep moving forward for the next person?
Well, I appreciate your comments. I'll just say about the things you listed, none of those things I can take credit for by myself, and some of them I can take almost no credit for, because all I did was find what was existing here when I started. Passionate people who had the smarts and the guts to go at big, difficult problems and solve them. The things that are going forward that, frankly, I'm gonna miss being a part of, are probably the most important would be the strategic plan. We just passed that strategic plan. It is innovative, and I would go so far as to say it's best in class for the thing that's most pivotal for higher education today, and that is student success. It is directly focused on student success, and unlike many strategic plans that colleges and businesses and governments have, that are 15, 20 pages long, our plan is one page long, one page that shows its laser focus on student success. And that is a message to the entire community here of what is important to us. And it focuses on getting students enrolled at HFC, identifying them who are struggling and getting them through to credential, and then getting them to the next step, which is either a job or a transfer to a four-year institution. And if we follow that blueprint, we can become the best college in the region and certainly possibly in the country on student success. And that also was not my handiwork. That was a group of people working twice a week at 2-hour segments for almost 3 months that we hammered out a really precise understanding of how we could serve students more effectively. And we also gave ourselves a big challenge. Most strategic plans are 5 or 6 years. This one is 2 years. So the urgency is like a red blinking light. And now, when our community is trying to recover from a pandemic, if we can operate on these goals, then we'll serve our community better, and we'll position HFC as the real partner for anyone who wants to use community colleges as what I believe they are. They are the gateway to the American middle class for nearly everyone in our community. And that would be the second thing I would say would be something that I hope our teammates and maybe a new president would focus on, is we have been getting students into higher education for the last 10 years better than we have for the preceding 40 years. We're getting more students in now, particularly at community colleges, but we're not getting them through the pipeline to successful completion. There's a leakage in the pipeline. And because the demographics of Michigan are, there are going to be less college-going students, we simply have to patch those holes, those leakage points in the pipeline. And the next step, I think, would be for a president to help the universities and employers pull our students through that pipeline more effectively, give them more of an opportunity to see the end of the pipeline, which is a job or a transfer. And I believe HFC will be really, really well positioned to collaborate with those partners to help our students continue to make it through that pipeline. So I'll just say, focusing on the strategic plan and then partnering with external entities to help our students through the student success journey during their 2 and 4 years here we have at HFC.
Well, you mentioned the value of public education, and certainly I think, we're certainly of this trio, we're all on board with that. Then there becomes the question of the accessibility. And I know that's been sort of a, I don't want to call it a political thing, but maybe it is about accessibility, student loans, things like that. What does that look like from your perspective in terms of what it means for the day-to-day students and what they need in order to make themselves better?
I briefly touched on this earlier, but certainly in the last 5 years, there has been a concerted effort, both at government and industry and higher education, to make at least community colleges more accessible to a broader swath of Michiganders. Most of that has come by way of reducing the cost barrier to higher education. We have several programs now that will either significantly reduce or eliminate the tuition cost barrier for students. And we've made a lot of progress on that. More students today than when I was a college going student have access to community colleges because of that. And I think, Alan, that trend will continue. We just saw 2 years ago there being a national discussion about whether free college should exist for two-year institutions. And I will tell you that will probably continue. We will have a continued national discussion about whether the first 2 years of college, primarily at a community college, will become something of an expectation or a real opportunity like we see now in society from K through 12. Question is how we'll afford that. I'm optimistic that the community colleges that see that as an opportunity like HFC will show the path. But as we move beyond that, from the idea that the cost barrier will not be something that holds a lot of people out, in other words, to solve the access problem, we will have to move to the success problem. And we've got a lot of growth to do on that as an industry. And I say that as a higher education world, especially two-year colleges, we have to improve the amount of success rate we have. And that's what our strategic plan has identified. Frankly, it called ourselves out for it. And industry's already recognized it. The Detroit Regional Chamber just 2 months ago gave us an award, not because we had such a great strategic plan and success in it, but simply for identifying that was a necessary growth point that we had to have. So while we have not completely solved the access problem, that barrier has almost gone down to nothing. Now the next big barrier for our students will be when we get them in. What do we do to do, as they say, meet the students where they are and shepherd them through the process to success?
President Russ Cavalluna is joining us on the WHFR Journal on this Friday afternoon. As you have likely heard the news prior to this interview, he is leaving his tenure here at HFC in late June to move over to Virginia, to the state of Virginia, to serve as chancellor of Virginia's community college systems. 23 colleges, over 40 campuses. And he thought he had it hard with 1, 2, 3 here at HFC, but it's all good. And we'll talk a little bit about this sort of bittersweet time. We discussed commencement. We discussed opportunities and plans that are in the works, Russ, in terms of your commitment to this community, in which I know will continue. And we hope we'll always have a special place in your heart. But so much of what we're talking about really does come down to partnerships and relationships. One of the things that spoke really strongly to me at the second commencement ceremony this past Saturday was Congresswoman Debbie Dingell's statements. She too, bittersweet, is leaving the Dearborn community because of redistricting. And it really kind of felt like the two of you together were sort of saying your proverbial goodbyes in a manner of speaking while still imparting words of wisdom and advice and so on. I think it's safe to say most anybody that has known you or worked with you over these 4 years has had great respect and value for the partnerships that you've made, not only within this college environment, but certainly as our listeners likely know, we are a K-14 institution. So through the Dearborn Public School System, that relationship has to work, or everything, you know, all the balls in the air will start to fall down. But external partnerships as well, including but not limited to Debbie Stabenow, Debbie Dingell, you know, those that are really the movers and shakers in the big picture of these United States. Would you speak to that just a little bit and just tell us how that process has helped you and what you think we've gained from it as a college?
Yes, I believe that community colleges are the most underappreciated societal support system that exists, probably only surpassed by religion and families. And I'm not suggesting that religion is something that it has to be there. If your listeners are not religious, that's fine also. What I'm saying is, you look at the systems that really help people and communities and society across them, from employers all the way down to individual humans. The community college system of our country, there are over 1,100 community colleges in the country and 28 of them in Michigan. They are so successful in giving people opportunity for better, safer, healthier lives. But so few people understand and appreciate them. And when I came to this job, I asked the board to give me an opportunity to be the biggest, loudest cheerleader for this community college. And I love that part of my job. It's just really, really fun for me. And part of the groups of people that I need to show what a wonderful societal benefit community colleges offer are legislators or powerful people in decision-making processes, from industry to government to higher education. And so we happen to have some pretty powerful legislators on the national stage in our area. One of them is Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, and one of them is United States Senator Debbie Stabenow. And so I make it my business to go and talk with them and explain how valuable, how students will earn $1,200 more a month with a graduation certificate in their hand from here, how our region needs to get itself out of the bottom half of urban regions of our country. And the only way to do that is to get more citizens with post-secondary credentials. How we bend over backwards to show people on our campuses that you are better when you understand and look at people who are different than you. How you are stronger when you can learn to talk to people that you disagree with. All that happens on these community college campuses. And so one piece of evidence that people are listening is that they'll come and talk to our students, which is what happened last weekend when Senator Stabenow and Congresswoman Dingell did come and talk. And if you've been around this community, you'll see that if it's one person or 200 people, if they're willing to listen about HFC, I'm there and I'm extolling the virtues of our college. So yeah, I am a complete believer in those relationships have to exist with the face of the college explaining why this college is so powerfully important, and unfortunately, a little bit unknown.
If we can pivot a little bit personally, let's talk about Virginia. What opportunities are you seeing there? What are you hoping to accomplish? Obviously, as Susan had mentioned, a large statewide district. Just sort of walk us through the progression from what you've accomplished at HFC and what you hope to accomplish there. And obviously, we know you're going to be maybe a little bit geographically closer to where, you know, some of those Michigan politicians spend most of their year. What would you expect the opportunities to be there and what you're when you hit the ground running here? We know what happened. How are you going to hit the ground running there?
I will say I call this whole transition bittersweet to me, because it is that. The bitter part is leaving colleagues like you and students like we saw last weekend, because I don't want to leave you and them. It is bitter. I love this job, and I certainly would not be leaving this job if it weren't for an opportunity that I simply could not say no to. And that opportunity is a statewide opportunity to try to help grow a system on those pillars that I just talked about, which is student success. And the community college movement is probably in its probably third evolution. The pivotal point where community colleges, the 1,100 of them across the country, are at a place now where access is less of a problem. Students do have access, certainly in Virginia and Michigan. The next pivotal analysis is going to be whether we can change ourselves to help them be successful, both during their time at community college and as they exit community college. And because we are such diverse learning communities, we have struggled to try to find paths that answer as many of those diverse outcomes that our students demand. Now, if we can accomplish that at any community college, the best thing to do would be to scale it, to set it up at a regional or statewide system. And we're making great progress on that at HFC. But in Michigan, we don't have a system that is over our 28 community colleges. Each of our 28 community colleges are very different. In fact, they are unique. At Virginia, there is a lot of individual talent at each individual community college, but they do have a statewide system that has authority to help guide best practices across an entire state. And as I mentioned earlier, my passions are public education, leadership of teams, and public service. And it was a hard decision to even apply for this job I certainly didn't go looking for this job. But when I looked at the things that I'm passionate about and the opportunity to lead an entire state that can be part of the third evolution of community colleges, where we really do hone and develop best practices to help students be successful, I will say that will be the immediate focus, is addressing those student success challenges that frankly exist in Virginia as they do here in Michigan.
Now, just when you talk about the idea of an overall state leadership of the community college system, obviously here in Michigan, we have, you know, geographic challenges. The UP is a lot different than it is down here in southeastern Michigan. In Virginia, that area near D.C. is a lot different than that western area of Virginia where you're getting into, you know, Appalachia. What are those challenges? And I'm sure you've thought about them and you're well aware of them. What are your thoughts on that?
Virginia actually is similar to Michigan in its geographic and political and industrial diversity. And you have identified two of the areas of that state that have very different populace and geographies. And each of them are served by a complement of community colleges, which rightly have different focuses and demographic focus groups. But here in Michigan, we don't have a central agency where we in Southeast Michigan can go talk to our leader in Lansing or wherever it would be in Michigan, where we could collaborate with the community college in Alpena or the community college in Traverse City. And we could develop statewide policy that would help us. That simply just doesn't exist in Michigan. Now, there's nothing keeping us from interacting with those community colleges, but there is no oversight leadership that commands. In Virginia, if there were something where there's collaboration between the community colleges in Northern Virginia and the community colleges in Southwest Virginia, which there are, by the way, and they happen to be the same issues that we're tackling here in Michigan, and that's student success and successful placement in job or university, irrespective of race, income, or geography, then the statewide system can support those best practices that do apply to the two community colleges despite their difference in geography, and then also craft and fund and support bespoke processes that help their particular populaces there. That simply doesn't exist in Michigan. And my hope and frankly, my excitement about this is to quickly learn from those leaders. And I'll be working with presidents at each of those community colleges to identify what things are statewide efforts and what things are individual efforts.
the goal, I'm sure, on your end of things and moving into this new position is to, as anyone typically would, take the things that you've learned from your life experience, from your professional experience, and hope that much of it, if not most of it, will carry over and provide a source of support and security and help as you, you know, focus that laser in the next direction. And it sounds like that's the goal. Well, let me put it this way. It has been one of those situations where you just really want the person to stay, but you know they've got to go. And kind of like that, you know, the hawk leaving the nest, if you will. There's the metaphor. But you know, most of us get it. Some of us are still a little miffed, not going to lie, just because we don't want you to go. But we get it. And it certainly has been a point of pride to serve our students in this college under your purview. And we will look forward to hopefully a solid and secure transition and a smart one with our next president. But when we talk about looking back at the legacy, and this doesn't have to, this can get as intense or as, you know, top level as you'd like it to be, but what do you want the, you know, people that have interacted with and, you know, still might, what do you want the legacy of President Russ Cavalluna, Henry Ford College, to be?
Well, I usually don't discuss this because I don't think it's actually an effective leadership strategy to talk about one's own legacy. I'll try to be a little bit responsive to you, but I'll start by saying this college is about to search for a new president. And part of my job is to set that next president up for success and to set you all and the board up to finding that next president who will be better than the current president. Because I think that's the real goal, and I think it's an attainable goal. So let me just quickly make a small pitch for any of your listeners who know people who might want to be a college president about why this is a fantastic job that people should apply for. The first is that this community college is set with a strategic plan that, if executed upon, will make it the leader for all of the metrics that will community colleges will be judged on for at least the next 5 years and possibly the next 20. So that hard work is done. Second, the community college has a team that can execute on that. In fact, that's one of the reasons I feel okay about leaving, because this team doesn't need me. In fact, they probably need a different president who can help them deliver on this strategic plan. But the team that exists now, excellent team, focused on students, caring about their community, and willing to unanimously adopt this strategic plan, which even calls out the things we're not doing great on. Third, this is a diverse community. If you care about what community colleges should do, which is help people get on the economic ladder to prosperity, despite their background, despite their income level, despite their educational attainment before they get here, you're not going to find a better place to do it, because our classrooms and our hallways and our sidewalks are filled with every walk of life and every viewpoint, which actually enhances the learning opportunity that you all know because you teach in those classrooms. Fourth, you've got a board who cares about the connection to K-12. So you're on a pipeline of actual public education all the way from kindergarten to, in some instances, 3 years after high school. I know that because my children attend the public schools here, and over 2,000 students are in high school and HFC at the same time. And this college is the pride point for this town. So of the community colleges around, if you are thinking you want to lead a community college, HFC is the one you should apply for. And I know that, Susan, because I applied for it. And during my tenure, there have been many community college openings in Michigan that I haven't applied for any. So this college is in a great place, and I'm sure you can find a president better than me. And with those attributes, you will. And the last thing I'll just say is I'd be really happy, if people look back and said, hey, well, what was that Cavalluna guy? What was he about at the college? What I would hope they would say is he found really, really effective teammates and promoted them to really important positions that made change. And to those that I work directly with, I would like them to think I was an honest and fair leader. acknowledged his mistakes when they did occur, and supported people when they made mistakes so that they could learn. But, you know, frankly, if this college is doing just fine without me, I'd be okay if I were just a footnote. My legacy will be much more important to my children and then their children. And I just wanted to be a decent leader for my teammates here at HFC.
Well done. Thank you.
Well done. Well stated. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I was going to say, you said you could take it at top level or you could dig deep, but that did dig pretty deep. So let's end on a light one. The one moment that you're going to carry away with you, on top of all of that, the progression of, you know, your family, your own personal career, stuff like that, just that one little interaction that's going to stick in your mind.
You know, Alan, there are so many. I will pick out one that's the most close in time.
Okay, fair enough.
Because it is at least somewhat emblematic of the moments that start to roll through my head. There was a student in the afternoon graduation last weekend, and she needed mobility assistance. She had a wheelchair that was controlled, that she controlled, but it was battery powered. And she, because of the mobility issue, she was the first graduate to cross the stage. And I think she was nervous. Like I remember when I walked across the stage, everyone was nervous. And she walked right, or she moved herself right past the area where she's supposed to hand the card so that the reader can read her name. And she made it about halfway across the stage. And I had seen, I meet with the graduates before the graduation where they're all waiting and we take pictures together. I get to know them. And I had seen her and interacted with her already. And it was a little bit of a difficult thing because we had to make her turn around or take that paper and give it back to the reader. And I didn't want to exacerbate any embarrassment she might have about that. But I mean, just an amazing, wonderful turn of events happened where she wanted to go back. And so we kind of got her to go back a little bit. So she had not just one time across the stage, but one and a half times across the stage. I got to walk with her during that time. And then we take a picture together. And, you know, I can see in this person's eyes, the initial thing when, you know, you realize, oops, I kind of messed something up and probably a stressful area. There was a little bit of concern in her eyes. And then as we're moving across the stage, I can kind of see that she's looking at the, you know, the several hundred people looking down on her. And there's still a lot of graduates that are waiting to get up on stage looking up at her. I can start to see the kind of anxiety melt away into some pride. And I'm walking with her to our place where we take a picture, and I take a picture with her. And I said, how are you doing? Are you doing okay? And she smiled, a 1,000 watt smile. She said, I'm doing great. And, you know, we shared a couple comments with each other, but that was a metaphor for what so many of our students go through to get to that place. And we get to kind of ride around on their shoulder with them for much of or parts of that traverse and watch the anxiety kind of wash away and the confidence build and then the pride exude. And, you know, I didn't come up in higher education, Alan, but the reason I went for it was embodied in that story. And there are, and then the metaphor that it encapsulates, I could go on and on and on about the students that you and I have had the pleasure to serve, because, you know, I've had a lot of jobs. I was a lawyer. I was a pilot. I was a professor. None of those jobs can give you what I just described in my heart, having been involved in that. And that just was 2 days ago. And the things that happen like that are so numerous, I couldn't go through them here or ever.
Thank you for that. It was a beautiful moment.
Well stated, indeed, yes.
Yeah. We know that you have made just a very strong impact on the students that you've had the pleasure of interacting with, connecting with, inspiring. And you also indicated in your professional career a variety of many hats being worn and many still to come. And I'll say I don't doubt as you're moving ever so closely to Washington, Russ, that you you could be president. But you may very well be president one day of these United States of America. But until that, or before that potentially happens,
who would want that job? Sorry.
Yeah, well, there you go. What about some advice and also as you mentioned, you know, being a parent, a spouse, and all those other sort of normal day to day things that so many of us relate to. Do you have some basic advice for future students of Henry Ford College that you won't have the pleasure to interact with in your new position? But any thoughts along the way that you've seen that just you want people to know coming in, you want new students coming in to know that you hope someone will tell them?
Yes, but before I do that, I'll just say your comment about proximity to Washington, D.C., I will tell you, I have no designs on elective office. But I will tell you, one of the things that Virginia gives an opportunity that Michigan doesn't is to get into the halls of Congress and continue to carry the flag of the community college movement. Because I hope in this interview you've seen, I'm all in on that. And we're not our best promoters. So advice for HFC students. This college is set up for you to make your best investment of your entire life. And that investment is your investment in yourself through public education. Your life is going to have a lot of different decisions. But if you take the opportunity to get educated here because of how good the education is, how manageable it is in cost, and how many support systems we have, and the return that you're going to get on that investment, it will be the most important investment you could do for yourself. And as long as you stick to it and continue to invest in yourself, this will be one of the few investments that you can actually control. You can control with your work and your time the return on it. And I know not everyone's a finance person, so I'll just phrase it in a little bit of a different set of words. You can change your life by coming to this college and taking opportunities that don't exist anywhere else. And everyone here is so strongly invested in that we'll help you along the whole way. And that will survive long after Russ Cavaluna has left, and it'll continue generation after generation because of instructors like you, Alan, and Susan, who care about it. And that's why HFC has been here almost 85 years. And my advice is to enroll and invest in yourself.
President Russ Cavaluna, Henry Ford College, outgoing president, serving this college community for 4 years and certainly leaving a indelible impact. We are grateful for your time today. We're grateful for your candor and your honesty and your stories. We know great things will be coming forward, not only in your new experiences, but certainly as we continue a rich tradition of great history, but a great look forward at HFC. So we thank you for the role that you've played in that part of the journey, and we wish you much success in the next one you're about to take. Thank you for your time today.
You too have been my teammate, and I'm gonna miss talking with you like we do here and like we see each other in the parking lots. And
it'd be great to do it more in person. I know, I get that. Yeah.
So and to your listeners, you guys should know we are a learning institution. These two have helped me. Susan has taken up the charge when I've said, hey, can you help me? I'm trying to figure out how to do this communication style a little more effectively, or can you help me critique some of my recorded statements? You two have been good teammates to me. I'm proud to have been in this mission with you, and I'll miss doing these interviews, and I'll come back whenever you tell me to.
Thank Russ, I was going to say the microphone's always open one way or the other, whether it's a Zoom meeting or it's the door to the studio. We'd be glad to speak with you again. This is the WHFR Journal. We're going to regroup, see how much time we have left, but we've got more on the way. We'll be back with more here on WHFR 89.3, WHFR.FM, making waves.
Take your favorite non-commercial radio station with you wherever you go with the WHFR radio app. now available for free in the Google Play Store. After installing the app, you can listen to WHFR live to your Android device anywhere in the world. There are also articles posted by WHFR staff and the latest updates to the WHFR schedule. WHFR to go, free delivery. Now available on the WHFR app and the Google Play Store.
Welcome back to the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek with you for a few more minutes on today's program. Kitty Love will be up at 2 o'clock, taking us on a trip down Highway 61, some blues for our Friday afternoon here on WHFR. Once again, we thank Russ Cavalhuna, outgoing president of Henry Ford College, for joining us on the program today and wish him well. We're going to continue and wrap up our program on a theme that we spent a lot of time talking about, and that, of course, is the value of education. And we're going to turn to a TED Talk, which came from the TEDx Mid-Atlantic Conference in 2012. And in her own words, we'll hear the story of Kakenya Ntaya, who relentlessly pursued her education, not only to go to high school, but then also to continue on to college and return to work with her village elders to build a school for girls in her community, changing the destiny of 125 young Maasai women in Kenya. A girl who demanded school. From TEDx Mid-Atlantic here on the WHFR Journal.
There's a group of people in Kenya, people cross oceans to go see them. These people are tall, they jump high, they wear red, and they kill lions. You might be wondering, who are these people? These are the Maasais. You know what's cool? I'm actually one of them. The Maasais, the boys are brought up to be warriors. The girls are brought up to be mothers. When I was 5 years old, I found out that I was engaged to be married as soon as I reached puberty. My mother, my grandmother, my aunties, they constantly reminded me that your husband just passed by. Cool, yeah? And everything I had to do from that moment was to prepare me to be a perfect woman at age 12. My day started at 5 in the morning, milking the cows, sweeping the house, cooking for my siblings, collecting water, firewood. I did everything that I needed to do to become a perfect wife. I went to school, not because the Maasai's women or girls were going to school. It's because my mother was denied an education. And she constantly reminded me and my siblings that she never wanted us to live the life she was living. Why did she say that? My father worked as a policeman in the city. He came home once a year. We didn't see him for sometimes even 2 years. And whenever he came home, it was a different case. My mother worked hard in the farm to grow crops so that we can eat. She reared the cows and the goats so that she can care for us. But when my father came, he would sell the cows, he would sell the products we had, and he went and drank with his friends in the bus. Because my mother was a woman, she was not allowed to own any property. And by default, everything in my family, anyway, belongs to my father. So he had the right. And if my mother ever questioned him, she beat her, abused her, and really, it was difficult. When I went to school, I had a dream. I wanted to become a teacher. Teachers looked nice. They wear nice dresses, high heel shoes. I found out later that they're uncomfortable, but I admired it. But most of all, the teacher was just writing in the board, not hard work, that's what I thought, compared to what I was doing in the farm. So I wanted to become a teacher. I worked hard in school. But when I was in eighth grade, it was a determining factor. In our tradition, there's a ceremony that girls have to undergo to become women, and it's a rite of passage to womanhood. And then I was just finishing my eighth grade, and that was a transition for me to go to high school. This was the crossroad. Once I go through this tradition, I was going to become a wife. Well, my dream of becoming a teacher will not come to pass. So I had to come up with a plan to figure these things out. I talked to my father. I did something that most girls have never done. I told my father, I will only go through this ceremony if you let me go back to school. The reason why, if I ran away, my father will have a stigma. People will be calling him the father of that girl who didn't go through the ceremony. It was a shameful thing for him to carry the rest of his life. So he figured out, well, he said, okay, you'll go to school after the ceremony. I did. The ceremony happened. It's a whole week long of excitement. It's a ceremony. People are enjoying. And the day before the actual ceremony happens, we were dancing, having excitement. And through all the night, we did not sleep. The actual day came. And we walked out of the house that we were dancing. As we danced and danced, we walked out to the courtyard. And there were a bunch of people waiting. They were all in a circle. And as we danced and danced, and we approached this circle of women, men, women, children, everybody was there. There was a woman sitting in the middle of it. And this woman was waiting to hold us. I was the first. They were my sisters and a couple of other girls. And as I approached her, she looked at me, and I sat down. And I sat down, and I opened my legs. As I opened my leg, another woman came. And this woman was carrying a knife. And as she carried the knife, she walked toward me, and she held the clitoris, and she cut it off. As you can imagine, I bled. After bleeding for a while, I fainted thereafter. It's something that so many girls, I'm lucky I never died, but many die. It's practice, it's no anesthesia, it's a rusty old knife. And it was difficult. I was lucky because one, also, my mom did something that most women don't do. 3 days later, after everybody has left the home, my mom went and brought a nurse. We were taken care of. 3 weeks later, I was healed and I was back in high school. I was so determined to be a teacher now so that I can make a difference in my family. Well, while I was in high school, something happened. I met a young gentleman from our village who had been to the University of Oregon. This man was wearing white t-shirt, jeans, camera, white sneakers. And I'm talking about white sneakers. There's something about clothes, I think. And shoes. And I'm talking about sneakers. And this is in a village that doesn't even have paved roads. It was quite attractive. I told him, well, I want to go to where you are, because this man looked very happy. And I admired that. And he told me, well, what do you mean you want to go? Don't you have a husband waiting for you? And I told him, don't worry about that part. Just tell me how to get there. This gentleman, he helped me. While I was in high school also, my dad was sick. He got stroke. And he was really, really sick. So he really couldn't tell me what to do next. But the problem is, my father is not the only father I have. Everybody who is my dad's age, male in the community, is my father by default. My uncles, all of them. And they dictate what my future is. So the news came. I applied to school, and I was accepted to Randolph Macon Women's College in Lynchburg, Virginia. And I couldn't come without the support of the village because I needed to raise money to buy the air ticket. I got a scholarship, but I needed to get myself here. But I needed the support of the village. And here again, when the men had and the people heard that a woman had gotten us an opportunity to go to school, they said, what a lost opportunity. This should have been given to a boy. We can't do this. So I went back, and I had to go back to the tradition. There's a belief in among our people that morning brings good news. So I had to come up with something to do with the morning because there's good news in the morning. And in the village also there's one chief or an elder who has, if he says yes, everybody will follow him. So I went to him very early in the morning as the sun rises. First thing he sees when he wakes, opens his door, it's me. My child, what are you doing here? Well, Dad, I need help. can you support me to go to America? I promised him that I'll be the best girl. I will come back. Anything they wanted after that, I will do it for them. He said, well, but I can't do it alone. He gave me a list of other 15 men that I went, 16 more men, every single morning I went and visited them. They all came together. The village, the women, the men, everybody came together to support me to come to get an education. I arrived in America, as you can imagine. What did I find? I found snow. I found Walmart, the vacuum cleaners, and lots of food in the cafeteria. I was in a land of plenty. I enjoyed myself. But during that moment, while I was here, I discovered a lot of things. I learned that ceremony that I went through when I was 13 years old, it was called female genital mutilation. I learned that it was against the law in Kenya. I learned that I did not have to trade part of my body to get an education. I had a right. And as we speak right now, 3 million girls in Africa are at risk of undergoing through this mutilation. I learned that my mom had a right to own property. I learned that she did not have to be abused because she's a woman. Those things made me angry. I wanted to do something. As I went back, every time I went, I found that my neighbor's girls were getting married. They were getting mutilated. And here, after I graduated from here, I worked at the UN. I went back to school to get my graduate work. The constant cry of these girls was on my face. I had to do something. As I went back, I started talking to the men, to the village and mothers, and I said, I want to give back the way I had promised you that I would come back and help you. What do you need? As I speak to the women, they told me, you know what we need? We really need a school for girls, because there had not been any school for girls. And the reason they wanted the school for girls is because when a girl is raped when she's walking to school, the mother is blamed for that. If she got pregnant before she got married, the mother is blamed for that, and she's punished, she's beaten. They said we wanted to put our girls in a safe place. As we moved, and I went to talk to the fathers, of course, you can imagine what they said. We want a school for boys. And I said, well, there are a couple of men from my village who have been out, and they have got an education. Why can't they build a school for boys, and I'll build a school for girls? That made sense, and they agreed. And I told them, I wanted them to show me a sign of commitment. And they did. They donated land where we built the girls' school we have. I want you to meet one of the girls in that school. Angeline came to apply for the school, and she did not meet any criteria that we had. She's an orphan. Yes, we could have taken her for that. But she was older. She was 12 years old, and we were taking girls who were in fourth grade. Angeline had been moving from one place because she's an orphan. She has no mother. She has no father. Moving from one grandmother's house to another one, from aunties to aunties, she had no stabilities in her life. And I looked at her, I remember that day, and I saw something beyond what I was seeing in Angeline. And yes, she was older to be in fourth grade. We gave her the opportunity to come to the class. 5 months later, that is Angeline. A transformation had begun in her life. Angeline wants to be a pilot so that she can fly around the world and do a difference. She was not the top student when we took her. Now she's the best student, not just in our school, but in the entire division that we are in. That's Sharon. That's 5 years later. That's Evelyn. 5 months later, that is the difference that we are making. As a new dawn is happening in my school, a new beginning is happening. As we speak right now, 125 girls will never be mutilated. 125 girls will not be married when they are 12 years old. 125 girls are creating and achieving their dreams. This is the thing that we are doing, giving them opportunities.
The Skater's Waltz, and I really wanted to ice skate. I don't know what it is. It's like, maybe it was the skates. You people who are skaters might know this, but when I would try to ice skate, not just having weak ankles, but it's like my feet would cramp up inside of the skates. Like it cramps in the arch of your feet. I don't know, obviously, but I'm past those days now, so it's all conjecture, really. Emil Waldteufel's music you hear still at many skating rinks and venues. The Gulbenkian
listener-supported non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford.
I'm Lynn Werfel.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
South of Memphis, Tennessee.